Tola.
Hi, Tim.
Tola, I've got a bit of a confusion here about various sort of Northern European countries, and I was hoping you could maybe help me out a little bit.
Well, I am from Minnesota, so I'm sort of an expert on Northern European countries. So fire away.
Okay. So this is a question of whether something is going to be Swedish or Danish.
Oh no. Okay.
So here we go.
Okay.
We'll start off with an easy one. Hamlet.
Danish.
Yes. Our next one is another fictional character, is a Muppet, known for saying bork, bork, bork.
I'm going to guess that he's Swedish. He was the Swedish chef, right?
The Swedish chef. Yes, indeed.
Excellent.
Okay. We're going to move on to real people.
Ooh.
Starting with some musicians, the band ABBA.
Swedish?
ABBA was Swedish. Yes, indeed.
Is still, are they not? They're still a thing, aren't they?
I think they are still around. About the electronic musician known as Trent Moeller.
Ooh. I'm just totally going to guess here. Danish?
Danish is correct. Yes.
Huh.
How about the pop artist Robin?
Oh, call your girlfriend of Call Your Girlfriend fame.
Sure. Yeah.
Dancing All Alone, I think is the other song. Swedish.
Robin is Swedish. Yes. Oh, let's see. What was next on the list here? Ace of Base.
Ooh, I saw the sign, of course, a favorite of, late 90s, pop radio. Danish?
Incorrect. Ace of Base is Swedish.
Dang.
Okay, and our last musician here is from Metallica, Lars Ulrich.
Oh, absolutely Danish.
Absolutely, yes. He is absolutely very Danish. Our next couple of questions are food-related. A fish-shaped gummy candy.
Oh, Swedish.
That is the Swedish fish, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
This one might be too easy. A flaky sweet pastry often made with fruit or cream cheese.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. Danish.
That's a Danish. Okay. We're almost at the end here. This one may be tricky. The region of Schleswig-Holstein.
Ooh. I want to say that's where a lot of the British royals that trace their ancestry back. I'm going to say, I would think Germany, but okay, Denmark, Danish.
You actually nailed it. It is today a state in Germany. But before World War II, it was all kinds of things, including Danish, and also a independent state for a while. Okay. Coming into to the home stretch here.
All right.
The poet Harry Martinson.
Oh my goodness. Swedish.
Swedish, yes, indeed. Harry Martinson is the author of the poem that today's film is based off of, and he won the Nobel Prize, which is Swedish or Danish?
The Nobel Prize is Swedish.
That is true, with one exception.
Yeah.
The Peace Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize, is Norwegian.
Ah, all right. The Norwegians get one little thing in there.
Yes.
How nice of the Swedes to give them one thing like that. You know, in Minnesota, a mixed marriage is a Norwegian and a Swede.
Ooh, wow. That's all right. Well, before we get canceled, I think we're gonna wrap up this particular bit. You got 10 out of 11 points. So the next
what do I win?
Then you win the ability to go back to Minnesota whenever you want.
Ooh, not now. Not in February. No. Minnesota is really lovely from about August 15th through about September 20th. It's really lovely. The rest of the year, more challenging.
Well, very good.
So are the author, Harry Martinson, did he win a Nobel Prize for this work of art or for a different work of art?
He won a Nobel Prize. Nobel Prize in Literature, I think, for his just for his body of work.
Oh, okay. It wasn't a one. It's okay.
Yeah.
Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah, yeah. He won it in 1974, which was after he wrote the poem of Eniara, which was, I think, he published it in 1956.
I'm almost surprised that he didn't wind up annihilating himself, Sylvia Plath style, given the content of today's movie. It would not have shocked me if you had told me that he had done that, just because rarely has someone tapped the a fundamentally bleaker view of human existence. But I'm glad to hear that's not the case.
Well, I have some bad news for you. He did take his own life.
Well, now I sort of feel bad about joking about it, but in fact, I feel more than a little bit bad, although I do sort of feel like maybe prescient a little bit. It doesn't surprise me. This is so bleak, Tim. I was telling you before the podcast started, like, I put this up there with a movie called The Rapture that I have seen that I also consider a good film, but yet a film that I cannot necessarily recommend to most human beings. And I don't know if I can recommend Aniara to anyone who, you know, doesn't have their therapist and/or their pharmacologist on their speed dial.
I might tend to agree. It's the sort of film, and for our listeners, we're definitely going to spoil it because that's kind of what we do. And so, if after you listen to us spoil it, you decide not to watch it, that's perfectly okay. But you can make your own judgments.
Yeah, yeah, that is. And you know, and there are bleak movies that I definitely think should not be watched. Like, what's the one about the home invasion one where the assholes torture a family and then kill them?
Oh, I think that was another.
Funny Games.
Oh, yeah. Was that Swedish or Danish?
I think maybe it's German, but I remember because I turned that off. And then I read later that the director had said that the only proper response to that film is to turn it off. Like he was basically creating a movie that was indicting the viewer for sitting through it because it was so, I mean, so that's when I don't recommend Funny Games to anyone ever. It's just an exercise in just sadistic cruelty for the sake of impugning the viewer or making the viewer part of the crime of the thing itself.
Funny Games is German. Austrian. Sorry, my apologies to any Germans. It's Austrian, and they made it. They made it twice. Originally in Austrian, and then they made it again in English with Naomi Watts.
Yeah, and I think the American remake was one of those what the hell beat for beat remakes where it was like exactly identical except with an American cast and speaking English.
Yeah. Just trying to
raising the specter of why the hell you'd make that movie like that.
Yeah, and that one, that movie in particular. Why would you inflict that on more people?
I mean, since we're talking about Swedish movies, that movie's not Swedish. But anyhow, coming back to the subject of Swedish film, there's of course another major Swedish film that got remade in America, and that was Let the Right One In, which is a great movie. Though not really science fiction, although I guess in a sense
it's a vampire movie. So
we should do a thing sometime about most misunderstood movie endings, because I think a lot of people think Let the Right One In has a happy ending, and boy oh boy does it not.
oh goodness.
But back to today's movie that doesn't have a happy ending.
No, it has a very clear ending. there's right. No ambiguity here.
Have you seen, what's it called, like Avenue C, the TV show about the spaceship that's like
Avenue Q?
That's lost in space. Avenue Q, that's what it's called. Yeah, this movie is like Avenue Q if it was directed by Lars von Trier.
Okay. No, wait. Sorry. Avenue Q was a musical.
No, you're right. Avenue Q is like a New York City kind of thing. Avenue. I don't know. Yeah. It was, Josh Gaff and some other people. It's
wasn't Hugh Laurie in it.
Yeah. I think it's Iannucci, the same guy that did, another bleak film, The Death of Stalin. Like we could just go on and on about super bleak films. Although that's also hilariously funny. It is however the most pitch black comedy that has ever existed in history.
Yeah. Avenue 5.
Avenue 5. Yes, a somewhat random title. Yeah, Avenue 5, if it was directed by Lars von Trier.
Okay, yeah.
I have to say, I just got to say, right at the beginning, a beautiful film in moments. Like, it alternates between claustrophobic and beautiful, though. Like, some of the, I mean, we'll get into it, but I was not prepared for how well this movie was filmed.
Yeah.
The production design is, I mean, it's not Blade Runner, but it's really good.
It is gorgeous. So this is, as we mentioned, this is based on an epic poem from 1956, which I'm going to sound all like fancy and film school-y, which I am not a person who went to film school. When I approach a piece of film that has been made from a piece of literature, right, it's always interesting to think about, do you read the source material first, or do you take them as separate things? And in this case, because it was based on an epic poem, I was like, why not? I'm gonna go read the poem first. And
and to be fair, you and I discussed doing that, and then I popped out. But because you're a better human being than I am, you actually went and read the text.
It may have something to do with me having a lot more time sitting on airplanes and in hotel rooms for various travel purposes.
Well, that's a nice way to put it.
Yeah, so we kind of start off with a bunch of like many post-apocalyptic movies, scenes of climate destruction. Kind of on the opening credits.
Yeah, it's fascinating. This was written in the 50s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. It anticipates the whole Rachel Carson Silent Spring, whole thing that erupted in the 60s and into the 70s. It's a very prescient film, let's put it that way. Or the book, the story is a very prescient story with what we now know about climate change. And by the way, if you're like, climate change, what a bunch of bullshit, just turn off the podcast right now. Like, this is not going to be the podcast for you. Come back for the next happy, funny film, because, like, if you don't believe that all sorts of terrible climate things are happening, then you're not going to dig this movie, and you're not going to dig our analysis of this movie, and, you know, move along and come back for the next film,
yes,
which might have a less politically searing analogy at its heart.
Yeah. Or I don't know, go watch this film and maybe it'll make you feel bad enough to believe in climate change and do something about it.
Also, the Earth is round. But anyhow, mm-hmm. Carrying on.
Yes. So we see first time we meet our protagonist before we even learn her name, which is she's amongst a group of people basically riding a space elevator and saying goodbye
we
to
her. We never learned her name.
Yeah, that's right.
We never learned. It's MF.
MR. MR.
MR. MR. Sorry.
Mima Robe, I think, is...
Mima Robe.
Right. Which is her job. And we'll...
Right.
Yeah. Which is kind of weird. And in the poem, she doesn't have a name either. She's the protagonist in the poem as well. Basically it's this giant space elevator filled with people saying goodbye to Earth. As we kind of pan across the crowd, you see some people with kind of skin lesions and various other things. Like, most people are sort of fairly healthy looking, but there's enough camera focus on people with evidence of something bad has happened to them, basically.
Yeah, it kind of anticipates Mad Max as well as other things. Yeah, people, clearly Earth is no longer a thriving environment.
And I think the way I think there's like a parent and child thing where it's like, do you want to say goodbye to Earth now? And it's like, oh boy, that's great.
It's like, no.
Yeah.
There's also tons of shots. Every shot of the Earth has at least one gigantic storm.
Yeah,
in it, right, showing that the Earth is being convulsed with bad weather.
Yeah. So the space elevator, and it's a big one, takes these folks up to this giant ship in orbit, and it's a big ship. Our protagonist, as we learn, is employed by the ship, and so she kind of disembarks and goes off. But as she does so, we see. And this is a I mean, this is a big ship with like shopping malls and tons of people and whatever else.
It's a gorgeous design. I mean, it is a singular spacecraft design. If you put up pictures of like 20 completely unique spaceship designs, this would be one of the 20 best ones, I think. It looks like, if you imagine, take your cell phone out of its shell, like out of its casing, right? And you just had like the motherboard, and you have all the electronics that are jam packed all over it, but it's like a rectangular shape with covered in various industrial things on both sides. That's what this looks like. It is such. I love whenever they do spaceships that don't have to be aerodynamic. You know, the classics being Discovery in 2001 and, you know, Enterprise until they decided it could fly through the atmosphere. But all those things, I just love it when a spacecraft, if it doesn't fly through the atmosphere, it doesn't have to look like a traditional spacecraft, right? And this does not at all. It looks like a long, skinny city block in outer space.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much like, what's the ship in Alien?
Nostromo.
Nostromo. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, This is a spaceship. It's very beautiful.
And it's going to a docking station on Mars, I think called Vals Marinaris, I believe. But it's the idea that, I mean, and Vals Marinaris isn't at the equator, so you can't have a space elevator right there. But yeah, it's going to be going just from a spot over the Earth to a spot over Mars.
Yeah, and as we sort of learn more about the ship, and they do a little bit of the, almost the trope of the, like, welcome on board speech that I think goes all the way back to what, 2001. You know, here's how the ship works. Here's our flight time to Mars. And, you know, we've got plenty of food on board, and all of our air is processed by algae farms and whatnot.
Yeah, it's a great line because it implies that we've got actual good air here. You're gonna love it on this ship. We have clean air.
Yeah,
can you imagine?
This is not Spaceball One. I think is what they're trying to imply here. You do not have to consume your air from cans. But that's interesting, right? Because it's like one of the things I noticed about kind of the people on board, and as we get further into the story, we sort of learn that like. Life on Mars is actually not all that great either. But the people that we meet are kind of largely like middle class, upper middle class. They all seem like mostly kind of well off and not like, you know, super destitute or anything like that, given their circumstances. This is a nice ship.
Yeah. Though. And that's always been my thing about like, we're never going to be able to off-world our way out of any problem. Right. Like we're never going, let's say we decided tomorrow that Earth was no longer habitable and we decided, oh, hey, we can go move to Ganymede or Callisto or someplace like that. You're never going to take more than a minuscule fraction. Even if you're in my employer and all the other private aerospace companies, you know, even if they all were incredibly successful, like you're never going to. I mean, if you were able to send a million people to Mars, that would be an unbelievable, almost impossible to imagine feat of logistics and engineering. And that's, you know, 1/10,000th of the world's population, right? So it's like, it's always interesting when I see movies that sort of imply that like, oh, regular people can just go, you know, visit the off-world colonies, exciting life of adventure and romance or whatever. Because it's never going to be very many people. The way that humanity is going to spread into space is that a few people will go to a new place and then they'll breed and then there'll be lots of people in that new place.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I just read a really good book called A City on Mars by Kelly and Zach Wienersmith that explores sort of the like, interesting sociological and legal implications of being a multiplanetary species, in addition to all the fun biological challenges. Highly recommend it, A City on Mars. Yeah.
Is it fiction or is it a philosophical sort of?
It's a pop science book.
Oh, cool. All right. Yeah, it sounds great.
Yeah, yeah. And they talk a lot about that, of like what sort of classes of people are going to be you know, the first city on Mars and so forth. Very, very interesting stuff. And that's some of these people, right? So, they're on this like super fast.
I'm going to make a bold prediction here, Tim. The children of the oligarchy. I know a lot of people are going to disagree with me, but I'm just going to say the children of the oligarchy, like, and the genetically perfect children of the oligarchy.
Gattaca? Is that it?
Gattaca. Yeah. It's going to be the genetically perfect offspring of the oligarchy. They're going to get to go.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but I don't think I am.
Those folks and the B arc, the Golgafrinchian B arc from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, with basically all of the people who are needed to like keep your telephones clean and fold your towels for you.
Right. The few things that GAI won't be able to do.
Yeah, cut your hair and so forth. So this ship, my guess is it's like a cycler. It probably kind of cycles mm-hmm. between Earth and Mars, just from the way they describe it.
Absolutely, it's clear that it's going to shuffles back and forth because it's not a very long flight, right?
23 days is what it is.
So I was ready to crap all over the orbital mechanics of this, but dang, if they didn't have their delta V's right. If you get going at 64 kilometers per second, you're going to exit the solar at Earth. Mm-hmm. If you're doing 64 kilometers a second from Earth, and you don't slow down, you're going to go exosolar.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out like, and the poem kind of goes into this in more detail, interestingly enough, to sort of like what's their propulsion system and whatnot. And it seems to be a little bit of a, like using nuclear power to follow like energy lines or something in space. It's a little, you know, we get to sort of the hand wavy Star Trek-y kind of thing. That is cool that there's like a real velocity in there.
Yeah, and they presuppose, I mean, she talks in technobabble, but in consistent technobabble about the discovery of a branch of physics and mathematics that, because she's teaching these kids later on about it. And it was, you know, and she says like it enabled the technology that they have now, right? Through the anti-gravity and all sorts of stuff like that. So they clearly say there's a, you know, there's an area of physics math that you know gets discovered that enables this.
Yeah, and the poem is full of even more technobabble, which is like I'm sure must have been so much fun to translate into English into the
translation. Oh my gosh, right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it made it hard to read as well. In some places because it's a lot. It's like I'd say probably an order of magnitude more technobabble than you have in like a Star Trek. All right. So the way that the movie is organized is kind of in line with the poem in that it's sort of set in sections, primary sections here. And being a movie, it's got fewer sections, although it's a pretty short poem, all things considered. And they're time-based sections. And so section number one is hour one. We get to see the onboarding and figuring out what this vessel is all about. And within,
I like how economically everything goes wrong very quickly. Like they don't waste a lot of time.
Yeah. It's a good use. And like, cause that's the whole point, I guess. once we get into the existential horror of the situation, right. The setup is maybe, it's interesting, but it's not as important. It's like these people are leaving a hellhole headed for not the best living conditions, but better than what they left behind on Earth.
Right. In that they're not.
And then all of a sudden, everything goes sideways.
Yeah. Although it does have that thing where they filmed it someplace with lots of space. You know, you and I know that actual rockets aren't going to have like an extra square foot that they don't need. What I always tell people is if you've ever been on a sleeper car on a train, now imagine that's your home. Like, imagine that's the home that you and your family live in forever, right? Like, that's the kind of space that is going to be, at least in, you know, the first few hundreds of years of human habitation in outer space. Like, you will not have vast vistas. You will not have a hallway that's got a half mile view through, you know, a big atrium or any of that kind of stuff, right? You're going to have tiny, tiny, tiny little spaces. And the first colonies on Mars are going to be like, you'll have a room the size of somebody's bedroom and like six people are going to live in there for 6 months, right?
Mm-hmm. I kind of got the sense that maybe this, that these ships, these cyclers were maybe built at a time, sort of like the peak of Earth's kind of economic capability, kind of right before the shit hit the fan and
could be,
and we destroyed everything.
Yeah. I mean, that would make sense.
Which would kind of explain
the sort of luxury, because there is a luxury vibe to like the hotel rooms. I mean, the rooms are very much, they sort of mirror the idea of cruise ships, right? Because they've got, the rooms have portal windows that look out and the hallways are very nice and, you know, nicely laid out and nice materials. It doesn't have an industrial feel, right? It has a cruise ship feel.
Yeah. Yeah. And even though our protagonist starts off bunking with another crewmate, once we get a little farther into the story, she gets sort of her own suite kind of a situation.
Well, she moves in with her girlfriend who's higher in the pecking order.
Well,
but yeah.
Yeah. Oh yes. Yeah. So with just moments into the journey, there's an accident. This was actually my least favorite visual of the film. It sort of looks like there's a screw floating in space and it strikes the spaceship and that's what takes it out.
Yeah, there's a bunch of debris.
Which from
right?
a
there's a couple you know, of
yeah. Yeah. And you see like the one that sticks in my mind is like there's this little screw. Which is from a, you know, at the velocity they're moving, right? What did you say, 64 kilometers a second? Like a screw is going to end your day, no matter what.
And if it's a cycler, I mean, it's just space is really big, right? Like low Earth orbit, you can have debris because there's been a lot of stuff put up there. But yeah, movies always sort of get it wrong, like how incredibly vast space is and how incredibly unlikely it would be to hit a particular thing, even a thing that something else had shed, you know, years before. But yeah, they hit some debris, and I like that they don't go into they don't bother with a lot of, you know, showing the actual impact or whatever. They just go straight to the ramifications.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think a little bit more, and I can't remember if this was explicitly described in the poem or not, or if I'm kind of inferring it, but like it seems like the way in which this ship moves around is in like if you imagine sort of fields of energy between the planets, there are areas of higher energy and areas of lower energy, and the ship somehow navigates along these paths of lower energy that enable it to kind of, you know, like a marble rolling through a folded sheet or something like that, kind of following the lowest path.
Yeah, although that would also tell you, well, I mean, they were a little bit vague as to the nature of what was going on. They said something about like they were avoiding some debris, and so they had to change their course and then hit some other debris. But of course, we all know that like it's hard to change your delta V, right? And so, and you would only need to change it a tiny bit to avoid a particular thing. And if you're then still on a highway, if you're on effectively a highway from Earth to Mars, well, there's going to be other ships that come along. That was, well, we'll talk more later. That was the thing, the part that I had the hard time with was that it's really not that far from Earth to Mars, right? Like you can look out your window and see Mars. There it is, right? I mean, yeah, you can't walk there. You can't bicycle there. But it's really not very far away at all in the grand scheme of things.
So we are also introduced to another interesting piece of technology on this on the spaceship, which is the MEMA. And the MEMA is introduced as basically kind of like a, immersive VR, you know, metaverse kind of situation. Although as our protagonist, the Mima Robe, introduces it, she explains that it kind of uses people's memories of Earth. And what's the phrase that she uses? Earth as she once was, which is like a really, really interesting way of thinking of things.
And people should think of it, it's really not like VR or AR. It sort of projects images into your mind. Like the people actually just are lying on the floor and they have these little pillow things around their faces. And it only works when you're pointing your head down, which is interesting. There's all this stuff on it, but it's not like a holodeck, right? There's no projection technologies. There's kind of a cool light show on the ceiling, but it's mostly a, you know, it puts images into your mind, basically feeding back on your memories.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a fascinating technology, and I found it a really like interesting example of like, here's this super advanced technology, and in the poem it's basically explained as like an AI, and we'll see shortly that its behavior kind of echoes that, this like super fancy amazing technology, and it's being used kind of as just an entertainment function. I mean, there's a lot of like super important like psychological value in having like this, being able to be immersed in like forests and stuff when forests apparently don't exist anymore. But also it's like there's an entirety of one staffer on the entire spaceship who knows how to run
a low ranking staffer at that. And yeah, no, nobody ever says like, hey, let's ask Mima to try to solve this, this whole problem of not being able to get to Mars. Nothing like that. Nope. It's just a toy for entertaining guests during their brief transit to Mars.
Much like all of the AI tools that currently exist today, in my opinion.
There we go.
We're just going to use it to make weird pictures that steal other people's artwork and to write essays for us.
Right. Cheating on high school classes.
So one of the things, so we're introduced to the Mima, I think I was pronouncing it Mima as I was reading it, and then I realized it's probably Mima. So we're introduced to this technology, and then yeah, shortly thereafter, the vehicle gets screwed.
Right, it all goes horribly wrong.
And basically they pull a Star Trek and have to eject the warp core, more or less. And so we start off with responding to this with the usual authoritarian, everything's fine, don't worry, we just had to dodge some debris. It's going to be a little bit longer than you'd wanted. We said 3 weeks, and it's probably going to be more like 2 years to get to Mars, but it's totally fine. It's totally fine. You guys, we have this.
And control. We're going to compensate you for your inconvenience. That was my favorite. That was my favorite line.
So it quickly turns out that the Mima is great when people start freaking out about this 2 week journey, 3 week journey that turned into what they think is a 2 year journey. Because people are obviously mad and they're like, well, why don't you come on here and lie down on the floor and dream about forests for a while?
I did love the staff answer, by the way. You know, we're off track, we don't have any fuel, but it's okay because we'll use gravity. We'll eventually cross something and we'll use gravity to get us back in the direction we want to go. And I just love it because I'm like, what a completely absurd answer. And then you realize that it's like in story, it's a completely absurd answer also. Like it's a completely nonsensical. Let's hope that none of these rubes understand even the most basic concepts of distance and, you know, velocity,
which again is like, I found utterly believable, right? Like just as here's this like super AI technology that has only been assigned one staffer to operate it. Here's a bunch of people who went to space without really understanding anything about like, you know, planets and orbits and stuff. That's just kind of people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we do learn from MR's roommate who is an astronomer. She's like, oh yeah, no, that's a complete lie.
Right.
It's like, as an astronomer, I can tell you there's nothing out there. We're lost already.
Right. She mentions a constellation that they're pointing towards, which if it's not one of the zodiac, it means you're not pointing towards the plane of the ecliptic, which means you're really not going to come across anything. Right. Like if it's one of the 12, constellations of the zodiac, then you're pointed somewhat in the plane of the solar system where you might potentially come across other things if you're extremely lucky. But the entire rest of the hemisphere of space, there's nothing for, you know, depending on where you point, you know, light years to millions of light years.
Yeah, it's the constellation Lyra that they're headed toward. That's all that I know about Lyra. I could probably find it in the sky if I had a map.
Well, there you go. Bold statement, yeah. Tim.
Yeah, I know. I'm a terrible aerospace engineer.
Well, to be fair, our need to read the sky, you know, celestially is very dim. Although I will say I'm doing a celestial navigation course this year for sailing. So there will be a point later this year where I will be able to tell you certain things about the night sky.
Well, very good. Well, I hope you never have to put your own life in the hands of knowing where the constellation Lyra is.
Yes, let's hope not.
So we wrap up the first section, this sort of like all the stuff that goes down in hour one, by a little note that like, oh yeah, also we're gonna run out of real food before we get to that 2-year mark, but it's cool, we have algae.
Although perhaps a nod fairly shortly thereafter, there's an explanation of like, and if the algae goes brown, it means it's bad. And then it's really Chekhov's algae, right? At that point.
Oh, yeah.
When you talk about what might cause, you know, how you might be able to tell when the algae goes bad, I think we all know what that means.
Yeah.
What one thing this movie does well, and it starts doing it fairly quickly, is it shows like the degradation of systems, like the entropic nature of complex systems. And this is not nodded to very often in science fiction. Science fiction often assumes that in the future we'll be able to make really like self-repairing and self-adapting systems. And that's just not how most stuff works. Most stuff is designed to work for a while, and then it's designed to degrade fairly benignly, but degrade it does, right? Every single thing that you make that's a machine will eventually break. And this is done well in The Expanse, where they have a process on Ganymede that they're like, once the system breaks, the whole system is going to fail. Like the biological gas exchange system is doomed, right? Which is a very scientifically reasonable thing to have happen. And this movie does a nice job of just showing sort of how everything slowly slides towards crap. And it's one of the things that when people talk about leaving Earth and going to other places, you know, science fiction so often shows that it's sort of easy to live elsewhere. And I think we're going to find it's very difficult to live elsewhere because that degradation of systems, you're just always going to be fighting stuff breaking. And you have to have on Earth, you have access to raw resources and, you know, you can, you know, take things X and replace thing Y with more of thing X. But if, you know, if you only have like one wrench and your one wrench breaks, you're screwed, right? And you can't make more wrenches.
Yeah.
And this movie does a very nice job of everything slowly sliding towards crap.
Yeah, it makes me think of the novel Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson, which has kind of some similar themes of the one thing that I found like horribly depressing about Aurora is I think there's a lot of it's like sort of fungus that get built up on this generation ship. Mm-hmm. And if you can imagine just the sorts of things that fungus can get up to with thousands of years in deep interstellar space with all the radiation environment making it evolve quickly. Good book, horribly depressing as well.
Nice.
But But, you know, on the positive side, right, we do have friends who are working on a clock that's designed to work for 10,000 years, for example, and which is a fascinating mechanical engineering challenge.
Yeah, it's kind of giving the middle finger to the whole idea of entropy, or at least temporary. You can't really ever get around entropy. But anyhow, a depressing concept, yes. Not the last depressing concept we'll talk about today.
No. So our next phase in the story here is starts in week 3, which is indeed a perfectly reasonable amount of time for the, like, oh no, we have 2 years of this crap ahead of us to sink in. As predicted, I think the Mima is in high demand. They got lines going out the door. Our MR is asking for help, some more staffing, and they're like, "Nah, you figure it out." She does meet what's her name, Isagel. She meets one of the pilots. It's a very just sort of normal human interaction. I think they like run into each other in the swimming pool, and like MR just sort of stares at her butt for a while.
Well, she gives her the eye in the elevator in the first, like at the very beginning. They have a meet cute in the elevator.
Yes. Sorry, this is where the pen I was using to take notes ran out, and I had to switch to crayon, which was the nice. Nearest
thing I love that you have crayons close at hand. I do not have crayons close at hand in my house.
So this is basically the point where her roommate, the astronomer, says, that whole like celestial body nearby thing is complete BS. And people are starting to get into sort of the existential horror that is this story, which is that deep space is scary because it's as I think William Shatner put it extremely eloquently after our employer took him to space a few years ago. You look out there and you see death. Like, deep space is death. There's nothing out there for you. That's this story. That's what this is about, basically. And so people are starting to have that revelation and naturally freaking out about it.
Responding in different ways, though, right? Because at one point, MR has a completely random hookup with a dude.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, her romantic interest sees her with this guy, and it's just like, you can't win. Right. And it's a moment of traditional, like, it's one of the few, like, traditional, relevant to other movies that you've seen before moments. Like, oh no, a misunderstanding between the romantic protagonists. This is relatable. And then nothing else is relatable. No.
But also, like, these are people, right? And they're people doing people things, which I think this story does, like, really well. So this is year 3 now. We're introduced to this thing called the Yurg, which I'm sure I'm mispronouncing. It's dancing, basically. It's how you deal with stuff is you go and dance. So there's a rave, and there's maybe some line dancing, and then this is where we see MR having a random hookup, and Isagel walks by, and she's like, "Oh, no, just making out with some random guy in the hallway. That's didn't mean anything. It's fine."
It's a total buzzkill for MR too. So she's the whole thing is just very miserable.
Yeah, yeah. But again, it's people, right? So like you know, what do you do in the face of bleakness? The poem really dives into this, and we'll see some more of the different people's reactions as you get cults starting up, you get raves, you get all kinds of stuff.
Right. The big three, right? Sex, drugs, and we'll use rock and roll as a euphemism for, you know, any big group activity, like a cult. But you know, the big time honored ways to not face the bleakness of human existence.
Yeah, and we also get introduced to, and I think it's the astronomer roommate who uses this metaphor of the concept of the Aniara moving through space is like a bubble moving through glass, which is like, this is just, I don't know. It's a very like, even as I say that, it's like sends a shiver down my spine. It's like space is big, so big.
It's great. And her point is that it's moving so slowly that because it's true, glass is a liquid. It's just an extremely, extremely viscous liquid, right? And so in like millennia, you can actually watch a glass window slowly get thicker at the bottom and thinner at the top. Her point is that you can't see the movement of the bubble in the glass. That's the kind of, you know, their entire, all this motion of Aniara in the cosmos is nothing more than like that bubble moving through the glass. Yeah, it was brilliant. It was a really beautiful image.
Yeah. And so, of course, our one piece of psychological safety of the Mima at this point, perhaps predictably, it overloads, right? And just people are using it nonstop 24/7 or whatever their ship's clock is, like all the time. And it
doesn't just overload, though. It basically says, you humans are the worst. And the best thing that I can do is basically to not stave off your self-destruction, is essentially what it says. Yeah. It's like, you know, I'm done saving you people from your horror. And then it kills itself, itself up.
Yeah. Yeah, it has a voice too, which is you don't hear it very often, but yeah, right before it melts down its own core or whatever, it says something like, there is no protection from mankind, and then it's like, peace out, I'm done. Y'all are screwed.
The original mic drop.
Yeah. And then of course, As per usual, the person responsible for keeping the machine running is blamed for its destruction.
Although it is also true that she would, somewhat selfishly, go use the Aniara machine after hours, and she'd let her girlfriend use the machine, and she sort of treated it as her own personal thing. So, you know, it's just part of coping. As again, you know, this movie is filled with, pardon me, recognizable human frailties.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think at one point before it melted down, she asked for, like, hey, can we turn it off for a while? Like, I think she asked for, like, a month to have it turned off and let it do whatever it needed to do. Although, you know, again, sort of given why this semi-intelligent piece of hardware decided to melt down, it may have had no effect, right? It may have just prolonged the inevitable.
Here's the great quote. Here's what Mima says. I've been troubled by their pains. In the name of things, I want peace. I will be done with my displays. There is protection from nearly everything, but there is no protection from mankind. Oh, man. This is the happy-go-lucky AI whose job it is to just, you know, give you, like, prancing woodland things. It would be as if the toaster in your house was like, you people suck, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm not making toast for you anymore at all.
No.
So she gets in trouble. Yeah, right?
She gets in trouble. Isagil stands up for her and
also gets in trouble.
Yeah. Also gets in trouble, yeah.
And by gets in trouble, I mean gets beaten up and thrown in jail, right?
Yeah.
The bad guys are not merely lying bureaucrats. They're becoming, you know, full-on fascist a-holes.
Yep.
Although I do love that the captain was, like, super into working out. Like, for a long time, almost every scene, he's, like, working out. Again, like, the denial of you know, what's another way to deal with the horrors of the world is like the ascetic, I'm just going to work out. I'm going to make the best me I could possibly make in this situation, which does not go well for him in the long run.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically like, what's his name in Firefly? Who am I talking about? Jane. In Firefly, the Baldwin uh-huh. Adam Baldwin character, whenever he has to deal with too much death, he goes and, like, works out. So year four, we're introduced to the cults.
Mm-hmm.
And we see, I seem to remember there are a lot more cults that get introduced in the poem, but you know, this being a movie, we see these shots of kind of a blinded cult leader leading a bunch of people through the darkness in one of the hallways, and kind of talking about light and how light is, you know, the thing that we need. And you know, you're not getting any of that out there in deep space.
Probably getting farther and farther away from the sun, right? So it's, I mean, the sun would have still been, even at 64 kilometers per second, the sun would have still been a major thing in the sky for the length of time that this, you know, the main story goes on here. But it would just be on one side, right? Like you'd be, if you happened to be pointed towards the sun, you'd see the sun, but in every other direction, you'd just see blackness with stars.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other cult that we meet is this sex cult of some kind, and they decide that that Mima needs to be canonized because she, you know, she died of grief for the loss of the Earth and whatever else. And this is also about the time that although as you said, MR and Isagel have been thrown in the brig. Presumably after a year or so, they get pulled back out again, and they tell them, well, we need workers.
And they both get good jobs. I mean, most people are algae farmers, surprise, but Isagel goes back to the bridge basically. And MR goes on to teach the kids. She must know, I mean, she must be a scientist, right? If she knows enough about math to teach, you know, this new vector math and physics stuff to the kids, right? She's clearly really smart.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if your job is to keep an AI alive, one presumes, I guess. It seemed like, when they showed it, it was kind of when I saw that scene, it was sort of felt like a stretch, but they're like, yeah, you can teach kids, right? You can, if you can teach an AI, you can teach kids or something like that.
I think they were just desperate to have anything that they could point to that would give people hope. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we'll teach the kids. And like the main leader guy, who's clearly a bad guy, says at one point, he's like, these little shits are our future, or words to that effect.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's all just bullshit. Right. It's the same thing as like them checking your shoes at the airport. Right. It just makes everybody feel better. And they're like, hey, we've got the security situation taken care of, folks. We're checking your shoes. So we got the kids learning the vector math.
Yeah, it does. Although I kind of got a little bit of a, like, maybe a little bit of a thinking about the future kind of vibe from it. In that, you know, the captain knows that they're going to be on this journey for ages. And so, like, yeah, maybe they should train some people who are a little bit younger, how math works and how to fly through space.
Yeah, I mean, the captain actually says we've built our own little planet, right? Like, and that is a recurring theme. There are people, there's this idea that Earth was a dump and Mars wasn't that great either. There's like this statement about like, there's only one kind of little plant that grows on the entire planet of Mars, which is, I think, a nod towards terraforming. You know, that you can build... Like, it's sort of, the whole movie is a war between the idea of, oh man, we're screwed, and the, like, home is where you make it, right? It's just that the people who are arguing that home is where you make it are wrong and swiftly proven to be completely, completely unrealistic optimists.
Yeah. Yeah. So year four ends with giant space orgy. And this is, and then our next section is year five, when it turns out Isagel is pregnant, presumably from aforementioned orgy situation. But she's super bummed about it. Mm-hmm. She basically says something like, "I don't want to give birth in the darkness."
She says, "I'm making a little prisoner," or words to that effect.
Yeah, yeah. And this motivates, or seems to motivate, MR to want to build something to kind of replace the Mima. She calls it a beam screen, you know, something to to show scenes of Earth, basically, to back to the crew again, back to the folks on this vehicle again. But she's told no, because that's a waste of time and energy, or I don't know, the captain's too busy pumping iron to even consider it.
But she does it anyhow, so.
Yeah. That takes us to year, let's see, yeah, so we're in year five, as I think you were alluding to earlier, oh my goodness, we found something else in space and it's headed right towards us.
This was the worst part of the movie for me. I totally did not understand. Explain what they tell us, and then I'll tell you, I don't get it.
So they call it the spear. It's basically a little cylinder flying through space, and it's the sheer improbability of it, of like anything being headed towards them, makes them say, well, this is intended for us. And so, like,
is it big enough to be nuclear fuel? Yes, it is big enough to be nuclear fuel. It's probably the Earth sending us nuclear fuel, which we can put back in our engine and go home and hooray, we're saved.
Yeah. Which, like, and this is the point when I sort of recognized there's no communication with Earth or Mars from this ship at all.
That's the thing. That's the part in this whole thing. Like I said, you can look out your window at Mars, right? It's there, and okay, the ship would eventually be flying away and stuff, but like, we're still in touch with the Voyager probes or were until recently, and they're outside the solar system effectively.
Yeah.
And they were built in the 1970s. Like, we would be in touch if this thing had power, and it had lots of power. It just didn't have propulsion. Yeah. We would totally, totally be in contact. And maybe Earth could help and maybe Earth couldn't help. I don't know. But yeah, they would absolutely be in touch with both Earth and Mars.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's sort of like the, you know, you kind of have to put it on the list of, all right, what am I going to suspend disbelief about in this particular story? I found it interesting that it actually took me this long into the movie to realize that they didn't have communication with Earth, because that would be the first thing, right? Is like right. Either call back home or call back to Mars, or like whoever paid for the journey, or like, I don't know, somebody's in charge, maybe, I guess.
Well, if this is a cycler, somebody wants the ship back.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the ship isn't actually that damaged. It just doesn't have any propulsion. Mm-hmm. You know, when this whole thing starts, it represents a sizable investment. Yeah. Somebody wants it. It's going to want it back. None of that stuff is an issue.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, well, here comes this thing. Our only explanation for it, whether it's some good logic or just hope against hope, or just magical thinking, they're like, well, whatever it is, we need to grab it. And we're just going to tell everybody that it has fuel, whether we believe it or not, because we need to keep people's hopes up. And the way they bring it on board too is like, kind of shows again kind of the technology of how this ship operates. It seems to be some combination of like magnetism and control over gravity and you know, wibbly wobbly timey wimey stuff, just to bring this thing close by and stop it in space, basically. Right.
Yep. Yeah. It wasn't clear to me how much they had to stop it, but yeah, they were using force fields of some kind to stop it. And then these weird grappling hooks. I mean, it's whatever, it's fine. But I mean, let's just cut to the quick. They can't figure out what it is. They can't cut into it. It's a, you know, I don't want to say MacGuffin, but it's like this, enigma thing. And I didn't get that. Is this supposed to be an alien spaceship?
Yeah, that's the thing, is like, you never know. Like, ultimately, kind of going back to the idea of this being a poem, and like, there's, I don't know, layers of allegory and whatever else, is like, this is just the final piece of hope that gets dashed.
Right. Right. The bit of lots of them.
Yeah. Like we said, this was going to be 2 years. We're now on like year six. You know, the 2 year thing. Okay. It turns out we lied about that. But for reals this time, this is our fuel. This is what's going to get us home. And then as soon as everybody realizes that that's not the case, like that's the end of hope right there.
Yeah. And the last glimmer of like a functional society, it seemed to me. Yeah. Like it just accelerates the whole system towards anarchy and craziness. But I didn't buy it. I was like, they're like, well, it's some material we've never seen before. I'm like, yeah, okay. You can always get into stuff if you drill, I mean, hard enough. I don't know. It just seemed a little too, in a movie that was trying to talk about how people would actually respond to things and how systems would fail and reasonable concepts. It just seemed like a little bit too tidy of a mystery. And it's one of the things I have with like a lot of science fiction movies, and not this movie usually, but a lot of science fiction movies will just have sort of random puzzle boxes that, you know, in the movie to just kind of make you feel like, well, I mean, they almost confuse, confusion with wonder.
Yes.
Right. And you'll have something that you can't explain, but on some level, who cares? But, you know, and just never get resolved in any way, shape or form. And it's just this enigma that sits in the film. And that kind of was what that rocket seemed to me. Really? Like you really can't get into it at all. It has to be an alien ship, right? They've never seen this material before.
Yeah.
And so if it's unlikely, you know, if it's unlikely, it's very likely that somebody could mount a mission to get, you know, some sort of rescue something to them from Earth. But like the idea that you would randomly come across a spaceship in outer space, especially, as I said, you're not even in the plane of the ecliptic of the solar system. It's just, you know, it's like, you know what it reminds me of? Space 1999 was, you know, they're on the moon, right? The moon is going through outer space. And they just always come across all these planets in interesting places. Like, that's not how the solar system is. I mean, the galaxy is just really big, and you won't randomly come across anything ever. You have to sort of aim for things and try to get there. So it was the part of the movie that I just found the most annoying and took me out of what was otherwise a tidy and nasty little experiment in how human beings would react to the worst news ever.
Yeah. So, right. So as a narrative device, I guess, yeah, it kind of gives it sort of gives the last little bit of hope and then completely dashes it. What it does do, I think, is it creates the conditions for the astronomer to get killed off. Emmer's original roommates, because finally she's like, all right, I knew y'all were lying about the whole like we'll run across another planet in 2 years thing, but I kept my mouth shut mostly. But this time, like, all right, come on, I can't do this anymore. And then the captain just shoots her.
Yeah, he just point blank murders her. Although he's using a taser, so it's not clear that he intended to murder her, but murder her he did.
Yeah. That's such as the use of a non-lethal device like a taser.
And the next scene, he's at her funeral, standing there looking solemn.
Yeah. So the one thing that this does, though, is it finally gives the captain a reason to tell MR that she can go to work on this beam screen device. He's like, fine, whatever, go and do this, distract people with your fancy light show. And she does. She makes this beam projector thing.
And it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful. In fact, as she's working on it, there's actually a very lovely scene as she was kind of trying to repair the MEMA first, or maybe get some pieces out of the MEMA to make the beam screen, and she's also got her kid with her, like a 1 year old. You know, as I'm sure you can also relate, you know, trying to do deeply technical work with the 1 year old running around, trying to steal your tools, not always great.
I was gonna say you can relate to working with the kids around.
I've definitely done a lot of work on my house with small children running around. It's like, all right, which tool can I give you to give you something to do?
That you can't harm yourself or others.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
or our house.
No AI repairs, though, at least not yet.
So she has this little triumph.
She does. And I guess this is where we've been talking about suicide throughout this episode so far. And I'm just gonna throw in one more trigger warning that we're gonna keep talking about it. So she has this great success. She's super happy. It's amazing. Like, here's this, like, we're like got waterfalls and stuff that we can watch instead of staring out in the bleakness of space. And she runs home to tell Isagel how amazing it is. And it's just like, I don't know, the worst. It's the worst scene in the entire movie.
I'll take a moment here to say something that Tim knows, but the audience doesn't. I, for 20 years, I refused to see movies that had scenes where kids got hurt because my kids were little and I found it so painful to watch things like that I just wouldn't do it. I just wouldn't watch any movies where kids got hurt. And so I've never seen, I'm going to totally blank on the Mexican director who did the fantasy. It's got a fantasy, but a kid gets hurt.
Oh, Pan's Labyrinth?
I've never seen Pan's Labyrinth. I wish I hadn't seen the Minority Report. That scene was really difficult for me. And so I was able to watch this scene in this movie today. But yeah, it was a super powerful scene. And the actress did a really nice job with it. But
yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's and there's an earlier scene that again, this movie does like actually a pretty good job of foreshadowing kind of throughout. There's sort of an earlier scene right after their kid is born and where Isagel is taking the kid swimming, right? Because the MR and Isagel love to go swimming, and she sort of lets the kid kind of flounder underneath the water for a incredibly disturbing amount of time. And then some random person walks into the walks into the swimming pool room, and she's like, picks the kid up and everything's like normal. And then like, oh boy, that's where this is going.
Yep. And that's where they go.
Yep.
Yeah. For mom and son. Yeah.
It's pretty terrible. So,
and poor MR has to find both of them in their room. So yes. And that's really, that just completely breaks her, right? That's kind of the end of her. I mean, she's really stops becoming the protagonist at that point, right? She's in a few more scenes, but she's no longer an agent of anything, right? Yeah. That just annihilates the last. And she had been really still trying hard to make the best of a bad situation and arguing that that's what you should do. You should try to make the best of a bad situation. And she just pays horribly for her small amount of optimism in a horrible situation.
Right. At that point, she just becomes one of the few humans that are just stuck on board this vessel. And in what I think is probably sort of standard standard level of irony so far for this movie, the next section of the movie is called the Jubilee, which is the 10th anniversary of their wonderful journey off into space, and they have a little celebration, and she gets a medal for making the beam screen and giving everybody waterfalls to look at. But like, nah, that's no.
Plus, at this point, they're sitting in a hall that looks like it has room for 1,000 or 1,500 people, and there's maybe 100 people, right? Yeah. So clearly, things are not going well. And the captain gives her this award, and his hands are bandaged up from what appears to be a suicide attempt.
Yeah.
Not going well. And she's just a blank. I mean, she goes through with getting the award, but she's like completely zonked out, zoned out. Like just dead woman walking.
Yeah, and I think this is the section where your Chekhov's algae finally comes back.
It's a fairly quick scene, but it's just seeing, all the algae is bad.
Yeah.
and there's nobody left to fix it. So everything now, the failure cascade is progressing, right? You get multiple things. You know, the lack of people means that you can't keep the farm going, and then it's all bad.
That takes us to our penultimate section of the movie. You're number 24, which they call the sarcophagus. And there's this, beautiful scene of the ship just sort of silently gliding across the screen, almost entirely dark.
All the external lights are gone.
And we get to see this, the blind, poet or cult leader or whatever, probably both, again, and talking about how she was blinded by a god, presumably for humanity's hubris or whatever. And this is the last remaining cult on board the ship. And then that takes us to our final scene, which is, in the movie, it's the year, 5,981,407 of their journey. And they reach the constellation Lyra. We get to see.
They reach a planet.
Yeah,
there's a planet in there. It looks nice. Looks habitable.
Looks great.
But everyone's dead. Yeah. And they're not just dead. They're just dust.
Yeah. It's just like a very, very creepy sort of pan through the inside of the ship with, you see a bunch of dust and what I thought was like a jawbone or something just sort of floating past.
Right. And that's it. Ta-da!
We made it. I think I'll read just because, I don't know. I actually like the ending of the poem a little bit better, because it's even more bleak.
Nice. Wait, even more bleak?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess maybe.
There's no planet at the end. Basically wraps up with in our immense sarcophagus we lay, as on to into the empty seas we passed, where cosmic night forever cleft from day, around our grave a glass clear silence cast. Around the Mima's grave we sprawled in rings, fallen into guiltless ashes changed, delivered from the stars' embittered stings, and through us all Nirvana's current ranged.
Nice. So a giant cloud of debris. Yeah, because they were casting corpses out of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you would have a constellation of corpses all around your ship.
Yeah.
Growing and growing over time until, of course, there weren't enough people left to eject the other corpses. And that's it. Ta-da! And, you know, thank you all for watching that movie. I said at the top, there are movies that are bleak like this that are, almost voyeuristic or, I would almost call it philosophical pornography, like where it's just rubbing people's noses in it for the lack of any artistic intent. This is not that, right? This has got it's a very serious FU to the people wrecking our planet and thinking that we're going to go do something somewhere else, right? To me, it's a real call to fix things here rather than hope for something better someplace else. Which is funny because I honestly truly believe that humanity does need to go into outer space, but it's not. I also think that we need to keep this place in great shape, right? Like it's not an either or. We don't get to off-world our way out of our problems. We need to both make this place great, but also go into outer space.
Yeah, right. And I was trying to think of do I recommend this movie to people? I guess, depends on the person.
Sure, I guess.
Yeah.
I would honestly be nervous recommending this movie to anybody that I knew had any depressive or remotely even suicidal ideation of any kind whatsoever. I think this movie is so bleak. The only movie that I can think of that that had as much of an impact on me in terms of bleakness, which has at least a slightly notional happy ending, is Children of Men.
Ooh, yeah.
Which I made the mistake of watching Children of Men at like 1 o'clock at night when my family had already gone to bed. And I was just like, this is a horrible experience for me. Like, I should have seen that movie with Tracy. But with Aniara, I specifically said, Trace, I don't think you want to see this one. I'm going to watch this by myself.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you watch it with Em? Did Em see it?
No. Uh-huh. I watched it by myself at like probably 1 o'clock at night.
There we go. The middle of the night, you can't do that, man. We live in an era. I don't know about you. I have to be really careful what I do, especially after Tracy goes to bed. Like, I can't read about politics. I can't read any of the shit posting that people do to each other in social media. Like, I almost don't read any social media late at night. It's too easy to just go to a really dark place nowadays.
It is. Yeah.
I can't believe you watched this movie at 1 o'clock in the morning.
I was trying to remember, other types of movies that are kind of equally beautiful and bleak, that I've enjoyed in the past. I'm kind of blanking on them now, but, certainly when I was younger, that was the kind of thing that I enjoyed watching. And it sort of speaks to the cynical way in which I view the world probably. But it's also like, like you say, there are pieces of this that are very, they're very motivating, right? Is like, mm-hmm. And like I mentioned earlier, after our employer took William Shatner to space, he talked very, very movingly about looking out into deep space and just seeing death as a contrast to this planet that we live on, which is the only place that has life, and how that motivated him to really kind of think more and do more about preserving this one planet that we have. I found that was the motivation, I guess, that I got from watching this bleakness to really understand, or to really underscore, the value of what we have here, and also just the difficulty of spaceflight in general, which is like the thing that we are doing for a living right now.
Yeah, and that humanity will do more of. But yeah, space tries to kill you, right? Space is fundamentally hostile to life. Right. You have to get very lucky if you can transport people reliably from here to any place else where you can have the sort of backup systems that you need to ensure long term safety. But it's interesting. So I was ready to not like this film because there's a kind of European negativism that I don't really like. Mm. Like, my buddy Brian really likes the movie Dancer in the Dark from Lars von Trier. I hated that film.
That's one of those films I was trying to remember.
Oh, there you go. All right.
I saw that movie in the theaters. I own the soundtrack. I was just listening to it the other day.
Yeah. I don't like Dancer in the Dark. I don't think as a piece of art, I think it just stacks the deck. It's like if you were playing D&D and the Dungeon Master was just like, well, now your balls fall off. Now you've got cancer. Now you've got, it's just like the omnipotent evil. This isn't what Trier was trying to do, but like, just having the deck completely stacked against you and then being told, see, the world is a horrible place. But mm-hmm. I will say I liked Melancholia, which is also a movie that does not have a super happy ending, which is also Lars von Trier. Did you see Melancholia?
I have not. It's been on my list for a while.
It cannot be our next film.
It's one of those of like every time I look at my to watch list, I'm like, oh, what should I watch tonight? I'm like, what about Melancholia? Nah, not Melancholia tonight.
All right. So we are going to get back on a more regular podcasting schedule. Now that we have our friend Paul Zastrow doing our sound editing, we're going to get back to publishing more regularly. And I would be up for Melancholia. And it's not just because I have a huge crush on Kristen Dunst, but which is true. But I would, down the road, after I can cleanse my palate with a couple of films that aren't quite so dark, I could do Melancholia.
All right. I'm adding Melancholia to the future list, but not the next time list. Are we, I forget, do we rank first? Let's, and then pick our next movie. Is that what we do?
Yes.
It's been so long.
It has. It's all my fault. Tim's been like, when are we going to get back to it? When are we going to get back to it? When are we going to get back to it? And I've been doing almost nothing that doesn't involve sailing. So it's all me, everybody. It's my fault. So, but we're back at it. Okay. So science fiction film. Science.
I'm gonna go. This is a tough one. I'm gonna go. I don't know. 75% science on this one. You know, the algae and the whatever else. There was the techno babble kind of hung together mostly well enough. But there was definitely a lot of stretches of imagination as we've talked about. So yeah. 75% for me.
What did we give? I'm going to look it up real quick here. What did we give Sunshine for the science? Let me look at my notes. Because to me, the science is about the same. 70. You know what? I was going to say 80%, and we did 75 and 80%, which is so it basically, yes, exactly identical. So I'll say 80% on this one also. Yeah, I consider the science pretty good. Yeah. I mean, you have to have force fields and but beyond that, yeah, it's pretty good. And the sort of systems engineering side of it was very well done. Mm-hmm. How about as fiction?
So having read the poem before watching the movie, I can't disconnect them now in my head. So I think this encompasses both. But from a fiction standpoint, I'm going 95%. This was a beautiful story.
Oh, because the knock on this film has been that it doesn't, I mean, the narrative, not a lot happens, right? I mean, things happen, but, you know, the character arcs, like, you know, what is the protagonist's arc? I guess it's just to destruction. I guess it's just to have her optimism flattened into dust over and over again. Yeah, I got to go a little bit lower. It's slow, right? The character stuff, but I'll still say 90%. Like I'm up there with you. I'm just not quite as high. And then film.
It's a beautiful film, is what this is. Let's see. I'm doing the thing that I probably shouldn't do, which is looking back at other scores. I'm gonna give it a 90%.
That's what I said. Yep. Same thing. Yeah. So here's the problem, right? So we're at 78, 92, and 90. People are going to see those scores. They're going to be like, oh, wow, the guys really liked it. Let's just go watch it. Yeah, but I mean, if you're still here at an hour and 30 minutes into the podcast, you've heard us say all the other stuff that we said about the film. And, you know, if it still sounds exciting, then yeah, you should see it. You should just know, like, there's very few movies that are this bleak that I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yes.
There's a couple of World War II films that are this bleak. Death of Stalin is actually in its own way this bleak. It's just that it's a comedy, but it's bleak.
If you liked Dancer in the Dark, you'll love Annie Ara. if you enjoyed Hotel Rwanda, you will thrill at the existential horror of staring in the blackness of space that is Annie Ara.
Yep. I think that's right. So, all right. And if anybody is watching this as a hate, or if anybody's listening to this and they're hate listening because they didn't listen to this first and they just saw our score and rushed out to watch it and, have to clean their eyeballs out with bleach, then I apologize. You know, what can you say? Yeah, it's a good movie. And it really is. The comparison for me is The Rapture, which I think is a very good film, but I would not recommend to most people for some of the same reasons. On top of it, it has a, stunning theological, argument at its heart, quite unlike any other movie that I've ever seen. But not science fiction, so we'll probably not do The Rapture anytime soon. All right. So what's next, Tim?
Oh, gosh. What's next? Let's see here. I'm looking through our list and looking for something a little bit happier.
Yeah, man. Don't you know it?
There's maybe a little lighter fare of something. If we want to go way back to something like This Island Earth, if we want to go a little wacky, we could go Buckaroo Banzai.
Ooh.
Or I believe we've also discussed going into the biopic realm and looking at Oppenheimer,
which I have not seen yet.
Neither have I.
I was going to see it with Aiden. Aiden wanted me to see it with him, and then we got busy, and I didn't get a chance to see it. I need something lighter than Oppenheimer, I think.
Fair.
I was going to say maybe Repo Man, which is a great film, but I think Buckaroo Banzai would be closer to. I mean, I know enough about Buckaroo Banzai, and I mean, my God, it's got Peter Weller and John Lithgow, both of whom before they were big, right? I think yes. There's a bunch of people in that movie that and the Star Trek guys love them, right? Evidently there's like a million little what are they called, the little things when you have in a movie where it's an homage to another movie, and what's the term for that,
a little Easter eggs.
Yeah. Evidently there's a million Buckaroo Banzai Easter eggs in Star Trek, the Star Trek Next Generation Technical Manual, which is Okuda and Sternbeck, talk about. I mean, there's like 50 Buckaroo Banzai Easter eggs in Star Trek.
Well, I'm gonna have to go see if I still have my copy of the Star Trek: The Next Generation Technical Manual.
I have mine. If you need to borrow it, I have the blueprints of the original Enterprise. They are on blueprint like type paper. The problem is that little 10-year-old Tola colored in all the elevator shafts in those. Documents, because they're easier to read because I wanted to differentiate between the hallways and the elevator shafts, because they have horizontal elevator shafts in the Enterprise, of course. And I mean, I'm sure it devalued those properties by like 99% by having those drawings in them, but oh well, they were well loved, right? And I know where the bowling alley is on the Enterprise. Not many people know that there's a bowling alley on NCC 1701, but there is.
There's
a swimming pool also. Think about that for a second.
About that.
All right. So Buckaroo Banzai it is.
How about that?
And we will be back, I guarantee you, less than – it's not going to be 6 months this time. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot less than 6 months, because now we have help on the sound editing. Paul did a great job on
Snowpiercer, episode 11. Supertrain. Yes. Thank you, Paul, for making it easier for us to do this podcast, which we do have so much fun with.
Absolutely. And thank you, Tim. And we made it through this film. We're still here. I did look up. Evidently, the author, the reason that he killed himself was bad reviews of his of a poetry series they did in the 70s. He was very sensitive to feedback. And it was poorly reviewed. It was also, he had got criticism for his Nobel Prize. And I don't know why people were critical of it, but they were critical of it. And unfortunately, that's why he ended his life. So very, very sad. But boy, did he create. I mean, I don't know if the book's good, but the movie sure is.
Yes. Yeah, I do. If you're into reading epic poetry, I do recommend recommend it with all of the same caveats and warnings as we just gave for this particular movie. If you do make it through this movie, please go out and, hug your children and your spouse and a puppy or whatever it is you need to do. And if you do need help, please do talk to a mental health professional. I highly recommend it.
It's true.
These folks are out there, and regardless of what the blackness of space may tell you, life is indeed worth living.
And try to reduce your carbon footprint if you get a chance. It's a big deal. All right. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Tola.
And to our fans, keep watching science fiction films. So much for listening to another episode
of the Monty Hall Effect. Our musical themes were written and performed by Guy Ellis, and Paul Zastro is our owl-eared sound editor. If you have any thoughts, feedback, or questions about the podcast, you can contact us at themontyhalleffect@gmail.com. Thanks, and keep watching science fiction films.